You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Mammal Watching podcast with me, Charles Foley, in Minneapolis.
And me, John Hall, also in Minneapolis.
Fancy that.
Oh, what a coincidence, Charles. I've just popped over for the weekend to see Charles, and it's delightful to be with him again.
Absolutely. We went out, spent a day mammal watching, didn't we? We drove to Wisconsin, about a couple of hours north of here. Drove around, just like took 4 hours to get there and back, drove around for another 3 hours. And in sum total, we saw how many mammals, John?
Let me just count. A squirrel.
We saw one squirrel.
Right by Charles's house.
Yes, that's right. I would say that was perhaps not our best mammal watching moment ever, was it?
But it was a lovely chat in the car. So to look on the bright side, but yeah, that's not the place I would recommend in December.
No, Craig's Meadows. It was raining all the way there, raining the entire time we were there. It was snowing all the way back. But anyway, that is Minnesota winters for you. However, you, John, have had some more luck with mammals on your recent trip to Chile and Argentina.
Yeah, thanks, Charles. Yeah, that was a good trip. I just got back and I was partly working remotely, and then I was looking for mammals in Chile a little bit. So Chile, I went really to Chiloé Island, to Park Tepehuayco, which is fairly well reported on in trip reports, but I went there in 2009, I think. And it's a lovely place, and it's the place to see Darwin's fox, Pudu, that beautiful little deer they have down in Chile. And I also heard it's still the place to see Cod. I thought in my mind, I think since a few people went there a few years ago, that the place wasn't the place it used to be, and it wasn't so good for mammals anymore. But that's not true, at least now. The owner's son, who spent a lot of time with me, is really into mammals. He's been inspired by some of the other guys from Chile who visited. They put up camera traps. So he's on a mission to really figure out the mammals in the park. Mm-hmm. And he's been seeing Cod, the little spotted cat down there, regularly visiting a little bait station and camera trap right in front of the lodge. Darwin's foxes are visiting every night. They're around. We pudu a common, and I got some nice pictures of those. We spent a lot of time sort of trying to look for Cod, but also exploring. And we didn't see the Cod. Unfortunately, but they're there. But we did see Monito del Monte, which was one of my key targets for the trip. It's a tiny mouse-sized marsupial, but it's the grandmother of all marsupials. If you look at the family tree of marsupials, this one's in a family of its own, and everything else in Australia and South America, I think, descended from this one. So yeah, it's a really cool species to see, and absolutely gorgeous. Hard to find, but the cook there is an amazing cook, but she's also the Monito del Monte spotter. She went out with her head torch, and she was getting them much quicker than we could. So Park Tepehuayco, talked to the cook, and we saw them very close to the lodge. Fantastic food, fantastic wine, a really nice few days there in Chile. And that was great. And then I had a week's vacation in Argentina, and I met up with one of these guys who's a top birder, called Marcelo Gabensky, who's one of Argentina's top bird guides, but has recently had a conversion to mammals. He's realized, you know, where the cool stuff's really at. And he's got very interested in mammals and promoting mammal watching. He did a trip with Martin Royal a year or so ago, and it was Martin that introduced me to Marcelo. And he's a lovely guy. He's a top guide, and he's so into his mammals. And so my main target for that trip was to see the Franciscana, little La Plata dolphin, as they're also called, very small estuarine inshore dolphin that's also in a family of its own because they're so distantly related to the others. It looks like a miniature Amazon river dolphin, just not as pink. And so we focused on seeing those in Buenos Aires province, just 200 or 300 kilometers south of Buenos Aires. What a lovely week. It's a beautiful area. It's all cattle stations, but all naturally farmed, no pesticides. So bursting with nature. We saw armadillos all over the place. We saw a couple of Geoffroy's cats, skunks, capybaras, nutrias, coypus all over the place in their native habitat. And we needed time there really to see these Franciscanas because although it's an endangered species, they're not uncommon in that stretch of coastline south of Buenos Aires. but they're very hard to see unless you get good seas. So we tried sea kayaking one day, which was a lot of fun and a bit harder work than I was expecting, but it was kind of rough and we didn't see them. And then we took a very cold, windswept drive along the beach, 25 kilometers, looking for them on another day. Again, didn't see them, but we did see elephant seals and sea lions on the beach, fur seals. And then the weather changed and the seas dropped really quickly, within about an hour, from white horses and white caps to almost nothing. And then we started seeing Franciscanos within minutes, and we saw them 2 days running from the beach. And Marcelo, our guide, had organized a local fisherman to take us out in his little boat. And we had great encounters with, I know, 10 or 20 animals over about 3 hours on a stretch of water near Mar Chiquito, is a little kind of resort town there. And Marcelo got some good video. Maybe, as far as I can see, some of the first video ever taken from a boat of these things.
Really?
So it's really lovely little clips he got of them. And Marcelo's thinks it might be the first ever time any ecotourists have tried to see these dolphins. So there's potential against this species is endangered and it's getting caught in gill nets and whatever. So there's a chance for more people to visit to see this, because they're quite easy to see when you get good seas and help turn the future around maybe for the species. Already I posted a video on Instagram, an Argentinian NGO have written to me who are working to protect the dolphins, and they're excited because they've thought about doing this for a while. So that's really great.
Right.
So that was a success. Marcelo has a heat scope now. He's really invested in trying to find mammals. He thinks he saw a bush dog a week or two back.
Oh my goodness, really?
Up in the Amazon, bit of Argentina. So there's a lot of potential. It's such an affordable country to travel in at the moment. Incredibly good food, lovely people, nice places to stay. Just best place to spend a week in November, I think I could have thought of. So I highly recommend Argentina. Trip report coming soon. And it's a bit different from Minnesota at the moment, I have to say.
It sounds like you had an amazing time, John.
Yeah, it was a good time.
And, you know, I have to admit, I really like the fact that so many of these high-end bird guides are now converting to mammal watching, because they do bring a definite skill set with them. So the more bird guides that can come over to the light side, the better.
Exactly. Yeah. No, they know that they've got skills. I mean, people like Carlos in Indonesia and Spain is another one. They know how to look for stuff. They get it, and they put their attention onto mammals. Janos, again, in Hungary, Romania, is another one of these guys who's really good at finding birds, but has seen the light and is moving over to the mammal side and putting their skills to work. And it's changing very quickly, and the amount of knowledge they're gathering, the focus they're putting on mammals. So it's opening up whole new areas. It's fantastic.
Yeah, the more the merrier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bring it on.
So we've just realized, before we turn to our guest today, this will probably be the last podcast before Christmas, the last podcast of 2023. So for those who celebrate it, a very happy Christmas, a very happy new year to everyone. Thank you for those who've listened, for all of you who are listening right now, I guess. Looking forward to talking to you next year and seeing what Mammals 2024 brings for us all.
Absolutely, yes. Merry Christmas, everyone. And I hope 2024 is a fabulous mammal watching year for you.
Indeed, indeed.
Cheers, John.
Cheers, Charles. All right, so Charles and I are extremely pleased to welcome Patricia Medici to the podcast today. Patricia is a Brazilian conservationist whose main professional interests are tapir conservation and tropical forest conservation, landscape ecology and communications. Patricia works for the NGO in Brazil called the IPE, the Instituto de Pesquisas Ecologicas, which I've said slightly better than before, but not perfectly. She was one of the founding members. Since 1996, Patricia coordinates the Lowland Tapir Conservation Initiative, and she's dedicates her life to the conservation of tapirs and their remaining habitats in Brazil. Since 2000, Patricia's been the chairperson of the IUCN SSC Tapir Specialist Group, which has a network of over 130 tapir conservationists from 27 countries. She's a TED Fellow since 2014, a National Geographic Explorer since 2019, and she's been honoured with far too many conservation awards to mention, but here are a few. The Harry Messel Conservation Leadership Award from the IUCN, the Future for Nature Award from the Future for Nature Foundation in the Netherlands, the Whitley Award from the Whitley Fund for Nature in the UK, the Columbus Zoo Commitment for Conservation Award, the William G. Conway International Conservation Award. You get the picture. If there's an award out there that you haven't won, I'm sure it's coming soon. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Great welcome, Patricia, and wonderful to have you here with us.
So, Patricia, could you tell us how you first got interested in wildlife?
Well, I grew up in the Atlantic Forest in São Paulo State. We had a little property outside of São Paulo City on the way to the coast. It's this highway that connects São Paulo City to the coast, to the southern coast of São Paulo State. And we had this property in the middle of the forest when we first moved there. It's different now, but when we lived there when I was little, it was just forest all over the place. So it was a small house, and we had animals coming to the backyard all the time: howler monkeys, capuchin monkeys, all kinds of birds. And and there are lots of kids in the neighborhood, and we didn't really have toys. What we did, you know, to play and have fun was just to walk around and walk trails and go hiking. There was a big lake near the house, so we would go kayaking and cross the lake to the other side where there was more forest. And so I think it comes from that. I blame my childhood in the Atlantic Forest.
So it's very natural, I think, to want to living in such an incredible ecosystem. So yeah. That childhood, you've now become who you are today. Could you run through your career and the progression?
Well, despite all of that, at first I wanted to be an architect. Don't ask me why, but that's, you know, I came out of high school ready to go through the exams to go to the university to become an architect. And then the high school where the school where I used to go to, they had this, how do I say this in English? It's this weekend where they had all kinds of professionals coming to the school to talk to the students. So if you want to be a biologist, you're going to find a biologist you can talk to. If you want to be an architect, you go and talk to the architect and stuff like that. So I went to this event with a friend of mine, and she wanted to be a forestry engineer, but she wanted to work with conservation and animals, and I wanted to be an architect. So I said, okay, let's go and talk to my architect, and then I'll go and join you, and we'll go and talk to the forestry, to the engineer. And this architect was the most boring person I've ever met in my entire life. He was miserable. Like, yes, architecture is great, but you know, it's a lot of office. It was just, you know, I was just like, I don't want to be that guy. It's just a really sad person. And then we went to talk to the forestry engineer, who actually he worked with the wildlife conservation, because it's, you know, it's part of being of this profession, professional background. And he was all excited. He was like, oh my God, you grew up in this, you know, in this, he knew the neighborhood where I grew up, and oh my God, lots of animals, and forestry engineering is super exciting. You could work with animals, and I could see that, you know, his eyes shining, and he was, you know, very happy about his choice for a profession. And that afternoon he gave a talk, and I went to his talk, and then the next day, literally the next day, I subscribed to take the exam for forestry engineering at the University of São Paulo. So it was risky. My mom was like, oh my God, what happened this afternoon at the school? but it made sense. The whole thing just, you know, kind of came full circle, because, you know, that's where I grew up, my history, my background, my family, and nature, and it was very important to us. And, you know, this thing, finding a really boring architect that had to mean something, you know, and, you know, and this very excited guy working on something else that made more sense to me. So I went to São Paulo University. I had to leave São Paulo because the campus for this course was outside, was 2 hours from São Paulo. So I left home. That's where I did my undergrad studies on forestry engineering, mostly, you know, just going, choosing all the courses, all the credits related to conservation and wildlife conservation, kind of old school, you know, the European wildlife management era. That's where you get when you do forestry engineering. Lots of management, not so much conservation, but that's what I did. Lots of internships. In the holidays, I was always somewhere during some kind of internship. And we founded IPE, the organization I work for, my organization, during my undergrad studies at the University of São Paulo. So I joke about this, that I pretend I'm a biologist, but I'm actually a forestry engineer. But after that, I continued. I did a master's on wildlife ecology and conservation and a PhD on biodiversity management in the UK. So I kind of, my career is a kind of a mix of a little bit of everything, if you will.
Right. And since then, you have now been working to protect lowland tapirs for almost 30 years. So how did that come about? What led you to tapirs in particular?
Okay, that's another funny story, because people ask me that question all the time. And I always say that there is no romantic story behind it, right? Because sometimes you ask a conservationist, oh, so why do you work with jaguars? Oh, you know, because I was passionate about jaguars since I was little. That's not my case. I was not passionate about tapirs since I was little. It was a relationship that we had to build over the years. But when we founded IPE in 1992, as I said, it was during my undergrad studies. We got together after we signed the papers, we created this organization, you know, and we got together afterwards and like, oh my God, what do we do now with this? We have an NGO now. So, I mean, we knew that we wanted to work with conservation, but what's going to be the focus? There were no things like strategic planning or, you know, things like that in the past, right? Almost 31 years ago. That was 1992. So we were sitting there drinking beers around this table at this bar. And we said, okay, let's make a list of species that we want to work with, species that we want to save. And but, you know, let's not go to species that, you know, there's lots of people working with already. Let's go to the underdogs. Let's go to the species that nobody cares about, to the species that are difficult to work with. So we had things like giant armadillo on that list. We had the bush dog in that list. We had the tapirs. We knew a little bit about tapirs at that point. Lots of researchers, mostly researchers working on hunting sustainability in South America, in places like Peru, Colombia, mostly in the Amazon. They were studying species that were hunted by indigenous communities. So there was a little bit of data on tapirs, because tapirs are heavily hunted in the Amazon, but nothing systematic, nothing long-term, nothing that generated specific data about that animal. So the tapir made it to that list. And I always really liked large mammals. So at some point, a few years after that, I just, you know, picked the tapir from that list and decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try and raise funds to try and establish this program. And so that's how, from that little list.
And do you remember the first tapir that you saw in the wild?
I do, because it was the first tapir that I captured. Had never seen a tapir before that in the wild, of course. So it was this adult female tapir, and she was standing in this pitfall trap that we had built for tapir captures. We had 14 pitfall traps in Morro do Diabo State Park at that point. That was 1996. And she was the first one that we captured. And I had a veterinarian, I had the equipment, I was ready for that. We had been trying to catch tapirs for quite some time at that point. It took about 8 months for us to capture the first one. So she was there looking at me and I was like, what the hell do I do now? And
they're really big.
She's ginormous. Oh my God. and yeah, so that was it. That was Joanna, our first taper. That was the June 22, 1996.
Wow. A day etched in your memory, I'm sure. Yes. Wow. So the tapirs in Brazil, they must have a range of threats affecting them. And so what are the primary threats for tapirs, and what sort of work are you and your NGO doing to help ameliorate these?
All right. Well, you know, you guys have been here. You know that Brazil is huge, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a multitude of different biomes and ecoregions and habitat types. And tapirs are found in five different biomes here in Brazil. We have been doing this for almost 30 years. And over the years, we kind of expanded our reach so that right now we are working on tapirs in all these different biomes, collecting information about them and trying to establish conservation strategies for them in each one of these biomes. And the threats are very specific. So when you think, if I have to answer your question very briefly, I would say the main threat to tapirs here in Brazil at the moment is roadkill, vehicle collisions in highways here. It's a huge loss. You don't drive anywhere here in the state of Mato Grosso do Sul, where I am right now, without seeing a tapir carcass along one of the highways that you're going to be driving through. You will see a tapir carcass. but if you look separately, if you think, you know, tapirs in the Atlantic forest, you're dealing with fragmentation. There's still, 75% of the Atlantic forest is gone. So, you know, only a small portion of this biome is still standing. So the reality there is fragmentation, tapirs living in very small disconnected populations. So that's the main threat in that case. If you think Pantanal, you think, you know, the edges. You go to the edges of the Pantanal where there's lots of loss of habitat and ranches starting to adopt the non-traditional cattle management practices from outside of the Pantanal. So that's the main threat to tapirs in that case. If you go to the Cerrado biome in the central part of Brazil, the open grasslands, the shrubland, the epicenter of economic development here in the country, you have a little bit of everything. It's tapirs in hell, as we always say. It's roadkill, it's deforestation, it's large-scale agriculture and cattle ranching, it's pesticide contamination, it's hunting, you name it. The Cerrado, it's where tapirs are in the worst situation. And the Amazon, this is our last program we started in 2021. Again, it depends where you are. If you're in the very remote areas in the center of the Amazon, in the big protected areas, you kind of have a tapirs in paradise kind of a scenario. But if you work on the edges of the Amazon, which is where we are operating, you have more of a Cerrado situation, more of a combination of different threats, including things like mining, that's huge in the Amazon, palm oil that's arriving in Brazil, in South America, if you will, very heavily, and lots of hunting. So it's specific to the area you were talking about, but roadkill is the main threat to tapirs in Brazil, for sure.
Right, and you said, I think you mentioned there were five biomes where they were, and I think you went through four of them. Where's the fifth?
Yes, because we ran this expedition to the Caatinga biome this year in March 2003. That's the very dry land, the one of the driest pieces of land in South America, in the northeast of Brazil. And in 2012, we had our first red list assessment for tapirs here in Brazil, and we listed tapirs as regionally extinct in the Caatinga, but based on very little data from some researchers and conservation organizations working in the Caatinga at that point, 11 years ago. And that always bothered me that we actually did that, that we listed this animal as locally extinct without having, you know, a lot of evidence. So this year we decided to go there and check it out and see. And we found tapirs in the Caatinga. So, but they are on the edges of the biome, on the interface with the Atlantic Forest to the east, and on the interface with the Cerrado on the west. And they come in and they come out depending on the wet season. If there's lots of rain, and if the edges of the Caatinga, the big rivers on the edges of the Caatinga, if they flood, they get enough, you know, water resources, they enter the Caatinga. If it's too dry, they stay out. So there is a little bit of a dynamic there that we're still studying. We're going to publish this results soon.
And do you know whether droughts is much of an issue for tapirs? And I say this because I heard recently that tapir population in the Chaco in southern Bolivia was seemed to be struggling because they seem to be running out of water in some of the areas. So is that something that impacts them regionally?
It does. It does. Even in the Pantanal, when it gets super, super, really, really dry in the Pantanal, they move out. They go to places where they can find water. And you see that we have a team of veterinarians working with us, and a big research component for us is related to tapir health. And so we monitor camera trap photos, the animals we capture, we run lots of exams, we analyze different aspects of their health. And during the really intense dry seasons, they lose lots of weight. Their body score goes way down. So yes, they suffer. They suffer a lot. And that's the main reason why they're not, I'm going to use the word residents. They're not really residents of the Caatinga, especially the center of this biome, because there is a very strong seasonality when it comes to water resources. So yeah, and the Chaco, it's a problem. They move out, they go somewhere else, and they come back when there's water available.
Right, right. Now, there are actually so four different species of tapir. So obviously you study the Brazilian lowland tapir, but then there's the Central American, there's the mountain tapir, and of course the one in Malaysia, the Malayan tapir. Are you involved in the conservation of some of these other species? And, you know, do they have similar sort of challenges to the Brazilian tapir?
Yes, I'm very much involved. I'm the chair of the IUCN Tapir Specialist Group, and we have members from 27 different countries, and we have members from pretty much all the different tapir range countries in Latin America and Southeast Asia. Few of those we're still lacking representation, but for most of them we have active members working with us. There is actually quite a few long-term systematic conservation programs for the other three species. When it comes to mountain tapirs, we have a very strong team of TSG members in Colombia. Another really well-established program in Ecuador. We have a long-term project under the umbrella of the Copenhagen Zoo in Malaysia, working on Malayan tapirs, and loads of excellent projects in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua and Guatemala. So yeah, and I'm really proud of the TSG because it's a group of young researchers from all over the place, and we work together really, really well. We have lots of joint projects because it's very difficult to raise funds for tapers because they're not considered to be necessarily charismatic, so they don't usually make the top priority lists of funding for most funding organizations. But over the years, we realized that if we joined forces, like, you know, if we organized alliances of different programs working on different projects in different parts of, you know, the distribution of the forest pieces, we maybe could be more successful. And it's been working really well for us. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm very much involved. We're having a taper symposium here in Brazil next year in July. We have this conference every 3 years. We had to skip the last one in 2020 because of the pandemic, but we're getting together again in July next year here in Campo Grande in Brazil.
That should be fun. And of those three other species, which one is probably most at risk?
Mountain tapers. There is less than 2,000 individuals in the wild in Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. So yes, they have a very limited habitat. They're up in the mountains, in the Andean mountains. So they share very much the habitat with spectacle bears. The situation for them is very, very similar. A lot of encroachment around the Andean mountains, particularly in Colombia. So yeah, that's the most serious situation.
And you were saying that they're not often seen as particularly charismatic, but actually there was a rescue young animal at a homestay in Colombia where I was, and this thing was like a house pet, and it had such a personality. Have you grown to love the species, and what do you think of it as you interact with it?
I when I say that they're not charismatic, I'm just repeating what people say. I don't agree. I do not agree. As I said in the beginning, it was a relationship I had to build but I love this animals and all the, but I also say that I love the questions that they help us answer. You know, the whole thing about tapirs being the gardeners of the forest and how they play with diversity and how they disperse seeds and disperse biodiversity and all of that, and how, you know, they're wide-ranging species, so how they connect all these different habitats and how they're, you know, considered to be landscape species and how they help us identify movement corridors for wildlife. So it's and how they are sentinel species. Their health very much guides surveillance in terms of what the population in the area is you know exposed to, particularly when it comes to pesticide contamination. So there's lots of ecological questions and health, public health questions and genetics and all sorts of, different fields of conservation that these animals help us answer. So yes, I love tapirs. I love the species. I'm crazy about them. I dedicate my life to conserving them. But I also love the questions that they allow us to try and ask.
So you mentioned putting the first ever radio collar on that female. What was her name again?
Joanna.
Joanna, yes. So I love the idea of trying to put a radio collar on a tapir. But how many animals have you collared over the years?
We have collared 151. The last one was 2 weeks ago. And but we have captured over 200. We only collared the adult ones, the fully grown individuals. But we captured lots of subadults and juveniles over the years too. But yeah, collars 151.
And does that process always go smoothly? Do you ever or not?
I think I have answered your question. No, it's a large animal, 250, 300 kilos sometimes. They're hard to capture. So we use all, you know, different methods, the box traps and pitfall traps and darting from a distance. And we have a team of vets working with us. And over the years, we, of course, we developed and perfected all the methodologies, all the drug protocols, you know, monitoring. We have all, you know, last generation good technology equipment to do the best we can to make sure the animals are safe, to make sure that we as a team that we are safe. The professionals working with us, they're amazing veterinarians. I'm super proud of everybody that works with me right now and everybody that, you know, came through the project over the last 30 years. But yeah, it's, you know, catching animals is always tricky and risky. And I wish I didn't have to do this because it's expensive, it's risky. And right now we have methodologies such as camera traps that answer a good chunk of the questions that before we would answer only with telemetry, right? So, and I'm very happy about that because, you know, catching animals, it's not as fun as it should be.
So there were rumors a few years back of another species, I think, in the Amazon, the Cabomani tapir. What's your take on that one?
That's the question that never leaves me. Yeah. Yes, it was described by a group of researchers from Brazil, from the University, Federal University of Minas Gerais, where I did my master's. It's a group of top researchers, top scientists, a really well-respected geneticist here from Brazil. I knew about the research. Two of them are members of the tapir specialist group. So we were talking about this as they were looking for, you know, samples and looking for evidence. They ran one or two expeditions to the place. There were other researchers here in Brazil talking about this region and how they felt like they had a different tapir in that particular region. This animal, it was smaller, it was darker, oh my god, it can't be, blah blah blah. And then this group from Minas Gerais, they went ahead, they collected a few samples from hunted animals. They had a few pictures from camera traps, and this was 2012 2011. And then in 2013 they finally got the paper published. It was a major challenge for them to get it published. They went through, I think, six different journals, and then they got seriously criticized because the sample size was very small, the data was didn't really bring enough evidence. And I, as the chair of the TSG, I went to talk to the chair of the Species Survival Commission at that point, Simon Stewart. And he said, well, we can't really take this lightly because it's, you know, the largest land mammal in South America, for Christ's sake. We need to make sure that we don't just accept it or refuse it. So why don't you put together a panel of professionals, different backgrounds, genetics, paleontology, evolution, taxonomy. Let's get these people together, people from outside of the tapir specialist group. Let's have them talk about this and make a recommendation to the TSG, to the commission. That's what we did. This group worked, this panel worked for about 6 months, and they came out with their results during the tapir symposium here in Brazil in 2014. And they said, well, we shouldn't not accept, we shouldn't recognize this species right now. We need more evidence in terms of, you know, genetic samples, in terms of camera trap photos. We just need more evidence. So we need the authors to go out back there and come back with more evidence. And that's still where we are, because the authors of the paper, of course, they were not super happy about the deliberation of the panel. And they, despite the fact that we had all the membership of the paper specialist group willing to help, willing to, you know, to go get samples for them, nothing happened for the past 10 years. So we're still waiting for that additional evidence. So Cabo Money, it's still not recognized, and it's a shame.
Yeah, oh, interesting. Do you have a gut feeling about it yourself, or is that something you won't talk about?
There is something there, because if you look at the photos, I have a huge database of photos of tapers from all over the place, pictures that people send me, pictures that I steal from the internet. You know, I have this big library of photos. And if you look at the description that they provide in the paper and the pictures that they show that I've seen working with the authors of the paper, and if you go through my data set of photos, you can easily tell this is Cabo Money. And then you look, this is Cabo Money. Because they're very, very different. They're much smaller and darker. But the bone measurements that they provided still leaves doubt as to was it a young individual or was it adult? So we're still not sure about that. So there's something there. There's something there.
I think you just need to hand it over to the primatological taxonomist. They'll spit it for you.
Yeah, I'm not going to be that person. Anyway. I just accepted the recommendation.
Definitely the wise course. So turning to Brazil and the future, for the last few years under President Bolsonaro, it looked like conservation and the Brazilian environment was in a really difficult place. But now President Lula's in charge again, and he seems to be saying good things about the environment. That's what we hear over here anyway. What do you think? Do you feel more optimistic now? If you were President Lula's advisor, what would you ask him to do next?
Lula, uy, uy, uy. Okay, yes, we are all the conservation community in Brazil is extremely optimistic. We couldn't be happier about the fact that, that Lula is the new president. Marina Silva is the minister of the environment. For Christ's sake, we love that woman. She did loads of good things for conservation for wildlife here in Brazil in the previous Lula governments. And she's now back. So I guess we're happier about Marina than we are about Lula, if you think about it. But yes, well, Bolsonaro, he completely destroyed all the legislation, all the conservation organizations, all the structure, everything we had in place. He managed to destroy everything in it was less than 4 years, because he started really fast. As soon as he started signing legislation against conservation. So the thing is that now it's going to take a while for Lula's government, for Marina, to rebuild everything, because the whole structure was just gone and nothing was in place. So it's going to take a while for them to actually be able to evolve beyond the point where we were before Bolsonaro. But they're trying their best, and we're seeing it's for us something really different is happening now. I've been to a conference in the Amazon 3 weeks ago, and the governor of Pará State, which is the Amazonian state in Brazil that has suffered most of the Amazonian deforestation in the country. And this guy comes from a long line of politicians in his region. Yes, and he's bringing the COP, the COP, the Conference of the Parties, to Brazil, to Pará State next year, 2024. And it was interesting to listen to this guy, a governor of a state, an Amazonian state in Brazil, that has in the past supported deforestation for decades, now bringing the Conference of the Parties to the country and attending all the different conferences of the parties every single year, wherever it's held, and discussing the situation of, you know, the climate and climate change and conservation throughout the world. So it's all very positive at the moment. We just need to see the whole thing, you know, coming through. It's more doing less talking in the future. We need that. But it's good.
So, Patricia, you are married to another very well-known conservationist, Arno Desvier, who studies the giant armadillo and who has also been on this podcast. And he also spends a lot of time in the field. And on top of that, you have children and some dogs, I remember from last time. So how do you make it work? How do you coordinate so that you can make it all stick together?
We don't.
Right, fair enough.
Yes, it's Arno and I, two kids, two teenagers actually, right now, and four dogs. And well, we always say that we're very fortunate that we don't really feel that we work. We feel like, you know, it's just working for us. It's such a huge part of our life. We work all the time. We are, both of us, we're workaholics, but we're very fortunate because it's, you know, going to the field, it's fun for us. It makes us happy. It's not something to like, oh God, I'm going to the field. No, it's, you know, ooh, I'm going to the field and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then, you know, I have this expedition and blah, blah, blah. So it's all exciting. It's more like a lifestyle instead of, we don't have jobs. We have, you know, this is part of our life. So, and we're fortunate that both of us, we are in the same situation. So we're happy for the other one. So I'm happy that Arno is in the Pantanal right now, enjoying, you know, Bahia das Pedras and enjoying that amazing place. And I'm here with the kids. And then, you know, he comes back and then I go somewhere and he's, you know, he enjoys the fact that I'm doing something that I love. So, and when it comes to the kids, since they were little, we took turns. So I go to the field and he stays with the kids. And then I come back, we spend a few days together and then he goes and I stay. And then that's how it works. And we like to believe that the kids are, you know, the kids enjoy the system, enjoy having single parents for most of the time. And we always, we try to deny the fact that this could be a problem by saying that, you know, the kids actually enjoy when we are, you know, one of us alone with them because they get the full attention. Otherwise, if it's the two of us, you know, we're talking and we're not giving them the full attention. But when it's just one of us, yeah, they get full attention. So, and the dogs, they never complain. So there.
Really? Oh, it does.
Very impressive, given how much you both. I mean, when we were trying to set up this podcast, you seem to be in the field an awful lot, as is Arno. So it's the amount of coordination that goes into that is very impressive.
Oh yeah, no, in the beginning of the year, we're getting to that time. It's usually, well, this year it's going to have to be now in December. We sit down, the two of us, with a bottle of wine, and we talk about the things that we would like to do in the following year. So I would like to have four expeditions in the Amazon, and there's this conference that I would love to go, and the kids will be on vacation from blah, blah, blah to blah, blah, blah. So we write everything down. We have a big calendar. And, I have to take this fundraising trip. Arno just told me before he left. March is mine. I need to do a fundraising trip. So don't schedule anything for March. And so we do lots of negotiation. And we come up with the annual schedule, which is set on stone. And it's not supposed to change, because then we need to organize everything with our teams, right? And you know, personal traveling for family and stuff like that. So yeah, we'll have that. We'll have the conversation soon before Christmas.
Better make sure it's a good bottle of wine with all that horse trading. But yeah,
or, yeah, it's usually more than one.
But okay. Yes, I can imagine.
So a final question. You touched on this a little bit with your reaction to Chelsea's comment about things ever go wrong with tapir catching. You must have had a few. You've obviously had a few, more than a few adventures. Are there any? Do you have any stories you'd like to share from the field? Work according to plan.
Oh my God, there's so many. I think that, there's two stories that I love very much that I always tell. One of them is the very beginning of the project, still in the Atlantic Forest, still, you know, learning how to catch tapirs and how, you know, how to manipulate these animals. We caught this huge female, not Joanna. It was, I think it was the third or fourth tapir in this pitfall trap. And we anesthetized her. She was down, and we were monitoring her. Everything was under control. And I went down. We had four people inside the pitfall trap with this gigantic tapir. So it's very, you know, small space to do everything we need to do. We still didn't. She was lying down on sternal recumbency, and so we couldn't really tell if it was a male or female still. So I was trying to put my hand under her butt to try and touch whatever, whatever I found, and trying to figure out if it was a male or a female. So I told everybody, I'm going to put my hand under this tapir. So watch out, because everybody knows that it's a very sensitive part of the body, and that could lead to an anesthesia, you know, how do you say in English? Animal waking up. Right. It's enough of a stimulus for an animal to wake up. So I did that, and sure enough, it was towards the end of the anesthesia. Sure enough, she starts to move, and everybody got really scared, and everybody trying to get out. And I just raised my arms, and I know I got out. I don't know how. Somebody pulled me. I don't know. All of a sudden, I was out of the trap. And my vet, Paulo, he stayed there. Nobody helped him. Everybody was helping other people, and but nobody helped Paulo. And he was just, you know, he had his back towards the wall of the pitfall trap like this. And then two of us, we were trying to pull him through his hands, but it was not enough. He's a big guy. And then somebody just grabbed in between his legs, just to pull him out. And that's, and then we have the video of this and the audio, like, not there, not there. So it's a horrible situation. And every time I watch this video, I'm like, oh my God.
Is Paolo a former vet now, or become an accountant?
He's no longer a vet.
I can imagine the tapir looking, going, yeah, that's how it feels.
And then she went back to sleep, and she slept for, I don't know, 40 more minutes, and we were like, oh my God. So yeah, that was the story, I guess. The second story is a jaguar story, actually, that everybody loves when I tell the story, because it's jaguars and everybody's crazy about jaguars. But we were starting in the Pantanal. We were a lot more experienced then. And I had this other vet, and he's super tall. He's 2 meters tall. Joad is my. And we were looking for places. It was a different ranch, not Bahia das Pedras. We were looking for places where we could do stakeouts and wait for tapirs. And we found this salt lick, this cattle salt lick. And we saw lots of tapir footprints around the salt lick. And I said, well, this is perfect, but there's there was no forest, no places where we could hide. There was just this little bush, tall grass right next to the salt lake. And then Joaris looks at me and he said, well, I think we can stay. We can fit there in the middle of that little, you know, that little bush. We can stay there with the rifle, and it's close enough to the salt. We can, if a taper shows up, we can do it. I said, okay, let's do it. And then the rest of the team stayed somewhere else, like 500 meters. We had walkie-talkies, and Joaris and I, we were by 5 p.m. We got there, and we were sitting in the, you know, in the middle of the tall grass waiting for tapers to come. That night, peccaries came, white-lipped peccaries, this big group of white-lipped peccaries. They came, they were licking salt for a long time, and they left. We had no tapers, nothing came, we went home. The following night, we came back, 5 p.m., Joaris and I were sitting there, and then all of a sudden, I had my head down, I was trying to, you know, get rid of mosquitoes. We were not using insect repellent, and he gives me a little nudge like this, and look, and I raised my head, and I was fully hoping to see a taper, and it was a jaguar, and it was this huge, ginormous male. I had never seen such a big jaguar like that, and it was just crossing the field right in front of us. And he looks at me. I said, "What do we do?" I said, "Well, he's not seeing us. He's just, you know, crossing the field. Let's just enjoy the sighting, and it should be okay." They're speaking like this, very whispering. Okay, so let's just enjoy the sighting. And then this jaguar comes and, you know, turns to the left and starts coming towards us. And we think he picked up the smell of the peccaries from the previous night. We don't know. But that was the guess. And this jaguar starts coming our way. And then Joaris, so what do we do now? So, well, it's still far enough. It should be okay. Let's just, you know, enjoy the sighting. And then this jaguar just, when he gets like 5 meters from us, and then we say, okay, now we shouldn't enjoy the sighting. We have to do something about this. And we just stood up. And as I said, Joaris is super tall. We just stood like this with our arms. I'm like, wah! And this jaguar had absolutely no idea that we were in that tall grass. He was, I remember his face. I was like, what the fuck? What the hell are you? Like, he was so surprised. He was shocked. And then in two big jumps, he just disappeared into the forest. And it was so funny because there was so much adrenaline. We were so excited that we were running around in circles like, oh my God, we just saw a jaguar. Oh my God, call the others, blah, blah, blah. Just, you know, pure excitement of this situation. And that was the best jaguar sighting I've ever had. But I just really remember the face of the jaguar, like, God, what?
yay. Patricia, thank you so much. That was just such an entertaining and interesting hour with you. Thank you for all the work you're doing, obviously. But I'd also like to thank Brazil's most boring architect for putting you off what would have been a huge loss to conservation in Brazil if you'd inspired. Thank you for joining.
Thank you. So I thank him every day too. So
right. Yeah, Patricia, I must admit, when I talk to other field biologists, I always try and like steal one of their really good stories. And I'm afraid that poor vet, right, being dragged out out of the pit by his gonads, I think is really going to, it's going to buy me a few beers. Thank you, indeed. This was a wonderful interview, and thank you for all of your stories.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share the stories. I take whatever opportunity I get to talk about tapers. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you as well. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.